Welcome to the Phil Tracy Monday Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 7:43 a.m. and that is on July 1st. So this is the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and I do apologize for recording a day later than normal. Fortunately, there were some circumstances I could not avoid yesterday, not least that the first Airbnb that we headed into had no air conditioning, and in Phoenix in July, that is what might be described as a necessity. So we had to run around and try and find a new place. Then we had to move to a new place. So it really was a bit of an ordeal. Now, we're at the end of the first quarter. So I think it's an opportune time to look at how things have gone in the first half of the year. Think about what's likely in the second half of the year, and then try and frame that into the broader perspective of what's going on out there in the real world, and how is it likely to affect the performance of various themes and trends over the course of the next several years. So, when we think about the value sector, then it had a big recovery at the end of last year. But then growth has really stormed back. So what looked like a very clear break of trend for the performance of value versus growth has rolled over. And we've seen that the Nasdaq was up 31.73% in the first half of the year, which is a really incredibly impressive rebound. And then the Dow Jones, which does include some of those technology companies, well, it's more considered, though, as a blue chip company or blue chip index. That was only up 3.8%. So when we then think about what's going on in the broader perspective, well, we have to definitely think that AI has had a big impact on the technology sector. But the big thing, though, is that AI's promise. Now, there is the big release of ChatGPT. It's one of the fastest acquisitions of new customers that we've seen. So if you go back and think about the rollout of the mobile phone, it took several years. Then there are lots of graphics online talking about how long it took Facebook and Instagram to get up to 1 billion users, and then TikTok blew past all of that, and now AI and ChatGPT have blown past even TikTok's race to get to 1 billion users. So that's a very significant move. It means that there's real popularity in what's being offered, and it's something that people really want to try and to experiment with. But then we have to consider, is it something that is going to be very popular for everyone, for everything? And what are the benefits that it can offer? What are the limitations that it has? So I saw one comment this week. It was from a doctor saying, well, it feels like I rubbed a genie's bottle 20 years ago, and finally I get my wish because AI can now help him to take notes so that he gets to write his notes following his daily procedures in a much faster manner. So that's certainly something that it can be used for. Is it going to solve all of the ills of the world? Well, I think that's a bit too far. When people start talking about it being the biggest invention since fire, I think that's a little bit over-enthusiastic as well. But that does not mean that it's not going to continue to inspire enthusiasm among investors. And we've seen some really impressive moves over the half of the year to date. And Apple is, I think, one of the really big ones, because it came through and hit the 3 trillion market cap in here on Friday. So this is really rather extraordinary. Now, we've had a very impressive move since the beginning of this year when it tested the 1,000-day moving average last, and it has subsequently done nothing but rise. So now the next question is, well, is this going to persist? And are we going to see an acceleration like we saw in 2020, where the price came down and tested the 1,000-day moving average in March of 2020, and then subsequently went vertical? And over the course of just a short period of time, March through to August of 2020, the price went up well in excess of 100%. And back then, Apple was a big company. Now it's an even bigger company. And what does it take for a company with a trillion market cap to go to 2 trillion? And then from with 2 trillion to go to 3 trillion? We're talking about massive volumes of cash. And it would be really encouraging if it was Apple had just brought out a new phone or a new product that just blows the minds of everyone. And they did bring out a new product. It was their VR AR headset. Now you have to carry the battery around in your pocket. It lasts for about 2 hours. And then they haven't talked about anything to do with the eye strain. It just looks like a better version of the Bit product that Meta have been playing with, which has been universally for gamers. Now, it doesn't mean that gaming can't be a big market, and certainly the chat apps that gamers developed have certainly been a really strong feature in lots of other social media type ventures. But there is something that is very isolating about putting on a VR headset from the people in your immediate vicinity. And that, I think, is something that nobody really wants to go back to. When you think about what the one lesson I think everybody learned during the pandemic is that people are social and we need human interaction and we need physical human interaction. And being in the same room as people is often enough. But being able to converse and just enjoy one's other people's company and exist together, that's part of the human experience. And then going into the metaverse is really not going to be a even a mild comparison for that. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to see applications developed for it. Now, Apple is approaching the $200 level, but I think that 3 trillion is a big psychological level, and revenue growth has not picked up. So this advance that we're seeing right now is about valuation expansion, and Apple is now trading on a PE of 32. So this is very much a growth metric, and it's the largest company in the world. Now, in order for the market cap to go from 3 trillion to 6 trillion, which would be a doubling, well, then either they're going to have to come up with a lot more money, or the money that they're making is going to have to go down in value a lot, or there's going to have to be a huge volume of new money created. So those are the potential options for the trend to persist. And of course, the sales of iPhones are also cyclical. And we're in 2023 right now. So a lot of people bought phones in 2020 and 2021. So we will start to see sales starting to improve in 2024 because a lot of the batteries will start degrading in those phones that were sold in 2020 and 2021. Then the big question will be, how will people afford to spend the money on the new versions? Or will they simply content themselves with the older versions, which tend to be cheaper? We are definitely in an overextended position, and the overextension relative to the trend mean is getting progressively wider. So the first downward dynamic is likely to mark a peak of at least near-term, potentially medium-term significance. But until we see that, then I think most people are going to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And then I think we also need to just marry this up with what else is happening in the world, because the performance of the growth sector is generally predicated on access to ready liquidity. And 10-year yields are now at 3.8%. and testing the sequence of lower rally highs. And you have central bankers talking about raising rates again and continuing to raise rates until they get the desired the desired result, which is to get inflation down. And this is ex housing. So I'm not sure that I'm going to get the correct one here. But if we simply look at services inflation, or we can simply look at just broad inflation, what we're going to be presented with is a trend that has peaked. And just broad inflation is, and I do apologize, this chart is not coming up for me. So we can see that inflation peaked back in June of last year at 9%, now at 4%. Now they wanted to get it down to 3%. And then they'll decide whether they've conquered it or not. The most important thing is that they are not messing around. And they do want to get inflation down. And they're doing it in such a way that they're trying to avoid the potential for a negative outcome in the wider economy. Now, the most interest rate sensitive portions of the market pulled back violently in 2022, and a lot of them have gone sideways, and the mega caps have recovered. And the mega caps have recovered because they have large balance sheets. Now, this brings me to a question that I think has been in the back of my head for a long time, which is that capitalism trends towards consolidation. So the biggest companies continue to grow larger, and the strongest consume the weakest. And that's what's happening in the technology sector. When we think about the size of the FAANG man, those just eight companies that now dominate the NASDAQ and have a market cap of 24% of the entire market, and it has now broken higher out of this range that's been underway since 2020, then this is a really significant event. It is a massive concentration of performance in the largest companies. Now, let's then look at the performance of the advanced decline line for the S&P 500, because it's been basically going sideways now for about 18 months. And that is basically telling us that the number of companies that go up versus those that go down on any given day is about equal. So even though we've had the extraordinary performance of the large companies, this is more of a broad measure of performance. Now, we should just zoom in on that range, because it does look like it's about to move on the upside. Now, when we think about the NASDAQ, then about half of the NASDAQ 100 is just seven companies. And Microsoft and Apple are the really big ones, because it's an adjusted or a free float weighted index. So Apple isn't actually no longer the largest company. Or I guess it may be after the move that we saw yesterday. Now, we've had this huge performance by these companies over the course of the first 6 months of the year. But the advanced decline line for the S&P 500 is breaking on the upside, which suggests that the other side of this pie chart, they're quite likely to outperform in the second half of the year. And that would be a broadening of performance. But then if money gets taken out of the big companies and put into I really do hesitate to call these small companies, smaller companies, then That's not necessarily going to mean that these shares just go sideways. They may just go down for a while. So, if we look at some of the retail companies, well, then Costco has been exhibiting this triangular pattern, which really did look like it could break on the downside, but in fact, it has broken on the upside. And that was a really quite dynamic move in here. Over the course of the last week, it suggests that investors are betting now that in the second half of the year, then it is the companies that really did nothing for the last year and a half might get some interest from investors. So, if we then look at the value growth ratio, it had the big move on the upside in 2022. It has come straight back down in the first half of 2023, and now it is approaching the region of the lows from 2020 and 2021. And this is a potential area of support. So, what I think is very difficult to rationalize is this continued belief that we can continue to raise interest rates and remove liquidity from the system. And the size of central bank balance sheets has been one of the, I think, the more important trends that we've seen over the last decade. And when the size of central bank balance sheets goes up, it has been very bullish. And it has been the factor that has contributed most to asset price appreciation. It's just a graphic representation of what quantitative easing looks like. So, whenever the central banks issue a lot of new money, when they're in there buying bonds, artificially suppressing yields, and really trying to inflate market activity, then that helps to really encourage investment. And it acts as a real tailwind to the broad market environment. And we see asset price appreciation really taking over. Now, the measure went up from 20 trillion to 33 trillion in between 2020 and early 2022, and now it's starting to come back down. So, one thing I think is rather interesting is that all of that money went out and around the world, and it went into the most attractive assets. And the thing that people really tried to lock down was something that would hold its value. So we've had a massive investment in property, and a lot of people wanted to own a home. And a lot of companies went off and bought trophy properties. So I think that was certainly some a rational response that the people were acting in an inflationary manner. They were thinking, well, if interest rates are this low and prices are going up this quickly, then I really should take advantage of the available liquidity that I have. And then they made big purchases. And then that had a knock-on effect for purchases and everything else, because well, as soon as you buy a home, you have to fill it up with stuff. So then durable goods sales go up and through the roof. And all of that was really supercharged by the volume of liquidity. But the size of the central bank balance sheets is contracting, and quantitative tightening is a global phenomenon. So, when we think then, it's just very simple. When we go back to the very first day of the chart seminar, what we talk about is that there are two big topics in markets. There's money supply, and there's price action. Well, the money supply is contracting. And that is going to make it more difficult to make money in the markets. Now, the most important thing, of course, is that that statement is completely countermanded by the strong performance we've had in the first half of the year. But of course, we had a very weak performance in 2022. We had very oversold conditions, and there was still a lot of money around. So we've had this big rebound. And now there's a growing consensus in the market that all of those old ways of looking at markets don't work anymore, that all of the naysayers and the doomsayers and the warnings were wrong. And if they weren't wrong, they were way, way too early. And that a soft landing is by far the most likely scenario, that in fact, there might not be a landing at all. And that the economy, having mildly slowed, will re-accelerate. So then the next question is, where's the money going to come from? Because central banks are restricting liquidity. We've already had a wobble in the banking sector, and we continue to see that the yield curve is seriously inverted. Now, then let's just think about there's two, I think, big lessons that we've had from the this compilation of central bank balance sheets redenominated into US dollars. The first is that a jump in the US dollar contracts liquidity for everyone else. When the dollar was very strong, particularly during a period where the volume of cash was increasing, it wasn't really problematic. But one of the reasons why the ratio started to come back down in 2022 was because the dollar rolled over. But now quantitative tightening is becoming a factor just about everywhere. So it's not just the Federal Reserve, but it's the ECB and it's the Bank of England, and it's lots of other central banks are reducing the size of their balance sheets. So they've taken it down by almost 5 trillion so far, and I think that they will basically unwind the pandemic. Now, if we see central bank balance sheets contracting by another 8 trillion, then that is going to remove a lot of money from the wider market. And there is a clear trend that that is likely to remain the case. Now, the bigger lesson from quantitative tightening is that it does get inflation under control. So, this is a monetarist's dream. And monetarism has been something that conventional economists have poo-pooed for several decades. But the reality is that you increase the volume of cash fast enough, you will create inflation. And if you withdraw it, then you will get a deflationary force. Now, you might call that a disinflationary force, but the inflation will come down, and that is exactly what we're seeing. And I'm kind of reminded of this new drug from Novo Nordisk, that it's been enormously successful in helping people to reduce weight from obesity. And people have been losing about 25% of their body weight in just a year. And one of the big questions then is, when can they stop using it? Because the trend of weight loss persists and people continue losing weight. And then as soon as they stop doing it, they start putting it back on again. Because the drug mimics some of the chemical responses in the brain. It doesn't change them. So then the appetite suppressor, when it goes away, appetite returns. And I wonder, is this kind of like what we're going to see with central banks? Because they're reducing the size of their balance sheets, and everybody knows where they'd like to have bond yields come down to, or the borrowing costs to be more accommodative, and they would love to see inflation at 3% and then not have to worry too much about it. But maybe then, because of this lagged effect from tightening monetary conditions, what happens if it overshoots on the downside? What happens if inflation does not just land, come in for a soft landing around the 3% level? What if inflation comes down through 4%, through 3%, through 2%, through 1%, and starts to come back down all the way to zero. Then are we going to have a deflationary shock? Personally, I think that is by far the most likely scenario, because it is exactly what has happened every time we've had a process of quantitative tightening. And that's what happened in 2019 in the USA. It's what happened in 2014 in the Eurozone. And now, globally, we're seeing a concerted, coordinated effort to contract the central bank balance sheets. And that suggests to me that we're going to have inflation coming down in an accelerated manner over the course of the next year. And of course, that is one of the primary reasons why the tech sector has been so strong. And it is pricing in the potential that inflation is going to disappear. And then that will protect their margins. And then they will be the companies that will prosper in an environment when central bank balance sheets start to go back up again. Now, this is the biggest question we have in the markets today. And I don't think it's possible to answer it, but I think we can make some guesses. The question is, what are central banks going to do when they actually do have recessions? Are they going to do exactly what they did in the last periods of growth shocks? Are they going to massively increase their balance sheets? Are we going to see the size of central bank balance sheets get up to 20 trillion? Are we going to see the Fed's balance sheet get up to 20 trillion? Are we going to see the total assets of central banks exceed 50 trillion? Is that what we're likely to see during the next crisis? Because that is exactly what we saw in 2020. Then we saw the first of the big leaps higher in 2008. And that trend of massive monetary accommodation has been the primary support factor for asset price appreciation, because it has just been this huge swell of new money looking for a home. And that home has been in asset prices. If central banks do engage in that again, well, then we're going to see a bull market in gold that is going to be very impressive. Now, the gold price is hovering here around the $1,900 area, and it did steady somewhat in here on Friday. It's been ranging for 3 years, and every time it gets above 2,000, it pulls back. On this occasion, the pullback has been reasonably mild, but it's not quite over yet. Now, we're at a potential area of support in the region of the 200-day moving average, and if this acts as an area of support, that would be very encouraging. But we are approaching a period of time where positive real rates are a likelihood, and that is why gold has been underperforming, because central banks have been very aggressive in raising interest rates, and then the inflation rate has come down, but the interest rates are staying up. So we are heading into a positive real interest rate environment, and that's not generally beneficial for gold. And that's been one of the reasons why it has been pulling back. But the reason that people are looking at this as a buying opportunity is that the positive real interest rate environment is unlikely to persist, and that we're going to move back into a negative real interest rate environment before very long. The only question, though, is when and how much of a negative real interest rate environment will be required. Now, there is then an additional question, and it is maybe the world has changed already, and we're not going to see the monetary accommodation that we've seen in the past. And instead, we're not going to see central bank balance sheets multiply in response to the next problem. Maybe we're going to see fiscal responses multiply. And it's going to be the fiscal response is going to be the key driver. And governments are able to print money, and this financial leveraging is one of the reasons that contributed to the first oil crisis. Because what we had in the late 1960s was a great deal of social upheaval, and we had the liberalization and the anti-discrimination movements that really gained traction in the 1960s. And you had a big swell of young people, and the baby boomer generation were the most dominant force within the US economy and in much of Europe. And they were demanding better conditions, better pay, and access to homes. So governments basically just printed the money. And that printing of the money, that broke the gold standard. That also led to the deflation, or excuse me, it led to inflation and devaluation of fiat currencies. And when the Middle East saw that the value of what they were getting paid for their oil was going down and going down quickly, they revolted. And then we had the oil crisis. So we have a lot of social upheaval right now. And we have a lot of people worrying about the climate. We have a lot of people worrying about rent, the price of food, the fact that wages are not keeping up, and that you have individuals being told by their governments that they need to tighten their belts, and they need to stop asking for more money, and companies need to stop trying to protect their margins, that everybody needs to go through a downsizing. Well, that's a really hard message to sell. And when people revolt against those kinds of ideas, then things can get really messy. So we are moving into a period of positive real rates, and that is what this chart shows us. So it's the constant maturity on the 10-year yield in real terms. It's now at 1.59%, which is higher than it has been in a decade. So when people go down to the bank or they get their money market funds and they go, "Wow, this is a yield that actually means something," well, they're not wrong, because we now have positive real rates. Positive real rates are something that will also help to get inflation under control, because it will act to suck savings out of consumption and into vehicles that will help to protect purchasing power. So there's this perception that manufacturing economy or countries that rely on manufacturing, they're much more volatile than the services, and services are much less volatile. But one of the challenges is that people need to work, and in providing services and generating income, what we also need to bear in mind is that there are actual creative parts of the global economy, and that it can't all be services, it can't all be social media, and it can't all be workplace apps. That companies also need to generate real products and real services in the real economy, and that it doesn't all happen online. And I think as interest rates continue to tighten, then the customers of the big service companies, well, they've run into issues. And a lot of the big service, the technology service companies, well, then some of their biggest customers are consumer facing. And consumers need income, and they need free cash in order to go out and increase their spending and to pay the higher prices and to sustain those corporate margins. So that's a factor of interest rates. And interest rates are still tight, and central bank balance sheets are still contracting. So I do think that there is clear potential for a significant rotation out of the mega cap companies and into the rest of the market. And if we can, well, I did create an X Fang index. So if we just look at those, that performance. Let me see if it still works. I may have to next week. I might have to just rewrite it to. Fortunately, this is not loading, so I will have to recreate it next week. But we can just look at the performance of the S&P equal weighted index, and it is firming, having really gone not much of anywhere for the last 18 months. It is firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and this range has been reasonably well defined and is pushing up towards the upper side of the range. So we may see a recovery in this portion of the market, the wider portion of the market, in the second half of the year. Now, I continue to see these predictions that we're going to have a massive commodity super cycle. And it will be driven by the lack of investment in oil and gas, and that will create the supply inelasticity market portion of the market. And then we'll have rising demand as a driven by electrification and electric vehicles. So, and I guess renewable energy more generally. And if that's going to happen, there'll have to be a massive increase in mine capacity, and it's exceptionally hard to build the mines. Now, I think lithium offers us one of the best examples. So, if we just look at the lithium price, then what we can see is that it's really volatile. Now, I'm looking at this on a log scale so that you'll see what the big market moves in 2012 through 15 looked like. But I think what's important here is that I can actually get the chart up. So, lithium carbonate prices only go back to about 2011. So the first Roadster by Tesla was released on the market in 2008, and they didn't build very many of them, and it had an inconsequential impact on demand for lithium. So prices really didn't do anything all the way through from 2011 to about 14. And because of that, we had a there was a lot of investment that was talked about, but it didn't really happen. And then EVs started to be manufactured by more companies. Now, we're still talking about very small numbers, but there was suddenly more demand for lithium. And then the number of internet-connected devices exploded in the aftermath of the release of the iPhone and then the iPad, and handheld devices went really increased substantially. So there was a huge demand boom for lithium, and the price of lithium went up very quickly. So between 2014 and 2016, the price went from about 40,000 to 200,000. But then the reality is that it's not that difficult to increase supply of lithium. So then we had this big response on the supply side, and the rollout of electric vehicles was a lot slower than the initial anticipated moves. So lithium prices came all the way back down again, and then during 2020 they collapsed back down to 40,000. And then we had a big move in support for electric vehicles, and the number of and the demand for electric vehicles has been growing at a compound annual growth rate of about 30%. And if you start compounding at 30%, well, you start getting big numbers really quite quickly. So then we had the supply impeded by lack of labor and weather events in 2021. And then we had the mismatch going the other way, and prices went straight back up again and hit another new high. And then came straight back down again because prices at those levels is really difficult, and China's reopening has been really disappointing. So there wasn't the same demand for EVs as was going to was initially thought of possible. So then lithium prices came back down again. Well, prices today are about 300,000. Now that is still 10 times where they were back in 2014, and lithium is still a bit player in the global commodity markets. Now let's just think about oil and copper. Well, copper is used in every country, and it's one of the most significant commodities in the world. And when we think about where the demand is likely to go, well, we also have to think that lithium prices have been going sideways since 2006. Excuse me, copper prices have been going sideways since 2006, with a great deal of volatility in between. And we're pretty much in the upper side of that range right now. And the price is here at about $3.75. So if demand doubles, and that is one of the most popular of the predictions, there will have to be a massive investment cycle in new mining. And we would have to see a lot of the rules around building electricity transmission wires really just thrown away. And that would have to then link up disparate renewable energy projects. So the thousands of miles of wires would have to be built to take solar energy to places where the sun doesn't shine, or take wind energy to places where the wind doesn't blow. And by massively increasing the electricity transmission network, then that could potentially allow it to deal with all of this massive variability in supply. One of the most significant factors that is less discussed is load shedding. So when you have a big surge of electricity coming in from renewable energy because it's a really warm day, well, often the grid can't take it because it's just too much flow. And the grid is not set up to take that kind of variability. So then it just gets shed away. So if we're going to have that kind of investment, it's not going to happen in a straight line. And right now, the most important factor with copper is China. They represent more than half of all demand. So if China's demand ebbs because, and most particularly, demand growth is already ebbing. But if China's property market does not fire because the government is unwilling to stimulate, then that's really negative for the copper price. Now, of course, if we have a new source of demand that will soak up all of that available supply, well, then that will ensure that we don't see a big bear market. That prices will be volatile, but that they don't go all the way back down to where they were in 2008. But it does mean that the super cycle isn't going to be nearly as impressive unless we see the regulatory changes required to build all of those transmission wires, because at the moment nobody wants those. And we have eminent domain is something that really hasn't been a factor in lots of countries for a long time. And eminent domain was about overriding the rights of the individual. And it was used with great tact by the environmental lobby to stop pipelines getting built, and rallying local communities, people that have historically been disenfranchised, and then saying, "Well, building this pipeline is through our ancestral home isn't something that we want, and we're just not going to stand for it." So now that those people have been educated, building transmission wires through that same land, are they going to simply sit down and take that because it's for the good of the planet, rather than and haven't they also gone through generations of governments coming along and saying that we're doing this because it's we know better than you do what's good for you? And isn't that what we're apologizing for right now, with in Canada and Australia, with the apologies that have been underway for the last few years about the re-education of the Inuit and Aboriginal children, or then the reparations demands that are going on in California, and the I mean, even in Ireland, which isn't a country that has been, it hasn't really had a slavery past. They are going to rename the Berkeley Library in Trinity to something else because he was a slave keeper several hundred years ago when there were very different ideas of what was normal. Now, let's just think that all of those examples, were they just used as a way to get regular people to do what a lobby wanted? And are we going to see the same action in place to stop transmission wires getting built? I think it's an awfully big question. And, we do see these trends. So if we're going to see a big move in eminent domain, where the rights of the individual are going to be trampled in service to a wider goal for society, well, that could be bullish in stocks. It's probably going to lead to a lot of social upheaval, and a lot of people are going to get really ticked off. But it's an absolutely necessary condition if we are going to see the kind of secular bull market that a lot of people are talking about in the commodity markets. Because to get all of that renewable energy up and running, we're going to need transmission cables everywhere. Now, are we going to see a massive new change in transmission technology? Because I do remember several years ago reading about microwave electricity transmission. It was from a New Zealand company, and that they could beam electricity between any two points using microwaves without using cables at all. And then talk about that disappeared. Maybe it was too early, or maybe it didn't work. But in order to get to the destination of EVs, we're going to need regulatory changes that are very difficult to get underway. And in the meantime, I think we're going to get a lot of what I really do feel like is that this talk about everything that needs to be done to mitigate climate change is contrived. That it's very hard to argue. And but the reality is that the changes that are required to effect to do the solutions that people want, even though we don't know that they would actually work, it's actually almost impossible to actually get done. And the solution that is most readily apparent is nuclear. And There's a growing trend of demand for nuclear, and the nuclear ETF, or the uranium ETF, is firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. When we think about the kinds of companies that really do need access to liquidity, then NuScale Power is one of those. One of the reasons why the share has been pulling back is they're not going to have a small modular reactor up and running for about the next 5 years, and they're going to need cash in order to do that. And then Fluor, which was one of the companies that decided that they were going to now become venture capitalists instead of engineering companies, well, they decided that maybe they're going to sell their position in small modular reactors because they don't much like this long return on investment. So that's one of the reasons why SMR is going down, because Fluor is looking for a buyer for its substantial weighting within it. So I'm less convinced by the commodity super cycle argument as it regards the development of a renewable energy environment. Now, what could happen, and I think would be one of the factors that could contribute to a super cycle, is if we see much more focus on a energy resilience type of argument. Now, there's been some speculation that the Permian Basin is at the peak of production, and that means that the cost of production is going to ramp higher in order to sustain the production. Now, if that's the case, and it will be the case at some stage, then the USA will have to come up with a new way of dealing with its energy, because the country has benefited enormously for the last 7 or 8 years by being energy independent, and that has allowed it to be much less engaged in the Middle East, and taking a back seat really to the security of or to global security. And as a result of that, there are wars in much of Europe right now, and a lot of uncertainty within the Middle East. So, excuse me, I just need to drink a bit, drink of water. So then, if we see that the USA needs to become energy independent again by focusing on nuclear and then also on renewable energy, then that could be something that would push that eminent domain into the main thoroughfare of conversation, and we could see a big investment. But we do need to see regulation match up, and we need to see new sources of demand. And the reshoring out of China is a potential new source of demand. And China might be attempting to unwind all of the liquidity in the market, and they might be attempting to unwind the bubble in housing, and that could help to free up commodities for development everywhere else, because we still have a global environment that is growing, and we still have at least 2 billion new people that will be entering the global economy over the course of the next 20 years. And they're going to need jobs, and they're all going to aspire to a better standard of living. And manufacturing does rely on cheap labor. So that's why we see increasingly garments that are being manufactured in India and El Salvador and Ethiopia. And that is going to persist. It's why I have been rather bullish on Nigeria, because it's a huge population country. Now, the ETF popped on the upside 3 weeks ago, and now it is coming back down again and pausing. And I want to wait a little to see if we get some additional weakness before initiating a long position. But I will have a long position in Nigeria, because it's where we're going to see economic activity become a driver for the African continent. And Mexico is the biggest beneficiary of the reshoring. Now, if we cast everything that's going on in the global economy as a great power, a competition between the USA and China, then that's an additional reason why the technology sector has been firing on the upside. Because in an environment where eminent domain becomes a more significant factor, then the technology that is being developed by the big companies will get absorbed into the US government, regardless of whether people want it or not. And that is perhaps the big change that we are seeing right now, that it is the power of governments is becoming progressively more important. And some people are thinking that that's going to be that we're going to see fiscal measures overtake monetary measures. But it might also be that we're going to see governments become much more interventionist. And I think that that is much more likely, that we are certainly seeing more countries talking about company profits being too high. They could simply intervene and they can create new taxes. And it brings us back to this whole question of capitalism trending towards consolidation. But taken to its logical conclusion, you end up with one company. And that's not possible. So what eventually happens is companies get so large that eventually they become targets, and you start to get antitrust measures, and then that increases the number of companies. And that is basically what's been happening in China. We had concentration of power in the hands of the government. They did not take kindly to companies like Alibaba becoming too large too quick, and then making comments about administrative duties of the government. So now Alibaba is going to split into six companies. Now they're casting that as antitrust. They're casting it as good governance. And in some respects, that is true. But what it is also true is that the government wants to be the only one exerting control. And that, I think, is going to also be exported around the world. And lots of governments see the success that China has in holding on to power and controlling their population. And lots of countries aspire to exactly that. And it won't take the same form, but we will see more control by governments. And we are in a geopolitically tense environment. So the wealth and ingenuity of countries will get devoted to national security efforts. And I think that that is very clearly a trend over the course of the next decade. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.